So we're joined today by Kieran O'Grady, who is a coach at Israel Startup Nation. So Kieran, first of all, can you just explain who you are and what you do?
Yeah, hi, I'm Kieran O'Grady. I'm a sports scientist and performance coach at Israel Startup Nation. I've been a sports scientist for well over 10 years, undergraduate and master's degree in sports science. Currently writing up and looking to submit my PhD in sports science as well. And that's all in cycling, all in endurance training. And that's how I managed to progress my way onto a world tour team. So for the past 2 years, I've been working at Dimension Data, and last year was NTT Pro Cycling. So that was the same team, but bit of a different name change halfway through. And now, obviously, this is my first year at Israel Startup Nation.
And what appealed to you when you were doing that studying in sports science? What were the kind of the main things that really appealed to you, I guess, early on in your graduate degree?
How to become a faster cyclist. Pretty simple. it was a pretty selfish reason that I chose sports science, in that I was a racing cyclist. I was like, hey, sports science, like maybe I can learn some cool training tips. And then, you know, the sports science took over the actual competitive cycling aspect for me. I realized that I wasn't going to become pro. And I was like, hey, okay, I'm pretty good at this sports science and coaching malarkey. So let's see where I can go with that. And yeah, I really fell head over heels for learning about the stuff that I had been doing for years, but without really knowing what I had been doing. So it was quite insightful in one way.
I guess the thing with cycling is, if you read a book, you know, from 15 years ago, and if you read a similar book now, the ideas that people had have completely changed over that amount of time. So how have you found it trying to keep up with what is going on in cycling, and kind of what is the best practices?
Definitely. I mean, from a sports science standpoint, it's incredibly slow when it compares with the work that I do actually with athletes, with professional athletes, because you're more at the coal phase there, whereas sports science always kind of seems to lag a few years behind what sports science practitioners are doing with athletes. But keeping a finger on the publication wire, as it were, is definitely useful as a coach in the world tour, to find out whether there's anything that you might have overlooked, or some research group somewhere that you kind of see something that they've done and looked into, and yeah, could provide an interesting edge based on what you know could be a limitation in one of the protocols that you're doing already, or a way to optimize something. So it's definitely a lot of my time is spent looking for new research.
And then do you just then deploy that with the sort of elite level cyclists that you're working with, that sort of research and, like you say, slightly different ways of doing it? Or do you test it somewhere else first before maybe delivering it to the elite guys? How do you sort of join up that research and science bit to then, as you say, the applied coalface stuff?
So usually we would have a discussion about an interesting paper or research idea in the performance group. So with a group of coaches and a couple of the DSs who are more sports science orientated, that way we can kind of have a sort of internal peer review of the paper. You know, do you feel like this is something that we can implement and is useful and is worth our time? Because there's so many things that we could potentially do with the riders and the team, but it's kind of what's going to give us the big return for, you know, not we don't want to make things easy, but we want to make sure that we're not chasing the rabbit down a rabbit hole for no reason. So once if we decide as a group, yeah, we're going to implement something, whether that's a training session or a recovery protocol or something like this, then we might choose a few select riders with which we would use as guinea pigs to give them a nice name.
Yeah, which I'm sure they're thankful for.
Yeah, and there's certainly some riders that are more open to trying new things than others. You know, always there's guys who put their hand up and say, yeah, that sounds cool. Like, I could see the rationale behind that. Let's see if it works. And so you might try it and do a bit of an evaluation, but it needs to be quite unobtrusive so that it's not going to damage their preparation towards a specific race or anything. So usually the time to try new things is in the off season, or in the period now, sort of December, January, February, before the big races. And that way you've kind of know whether it works or doesn't work before the season starts. Generally, once the season starts, the athlete's going to be so focused on upcoming races, recovery from races, that to try new things can be a little challenging sometimes.
Mm. And before creating a new intervention or new process to, like, say, whether it's training or recovery, would you always want the scientific research and the data to back that up? Or, you know, are you, you know, because obviously there's always whispers about other training sessions other people are doing, and you hear about opposition and what they're up to. Would you want to see that scientific evidence and the data first before trusting it? Or would you also go with an intuition or a feel about a type of intervention?
Definitely there's a gut feeling that needs to be put into place with a lot of these things. There's some old school training methods that science, you know, sports science research still hasn't put their finger on and said, okay, this is what's going on. But from practice, years of practice, you know that it works. So there is an element that you have to be a bit objective behind things, or subjective behind things, and say, okay, even though the science numbers might, you know, a scientific paper might say that it doesn't work, you kind of need to be confident in your processes and in your methodologies as a practitioner.
Yeah, and like you say, you never want to lose that gut feel, do you? Because as you say, that's built upon years of experience, and it usually works best when there's a marriage between the two, isn't there, of that mm-hmm. that experience of having done this session over and over again, and I've seen it with my own eyes, it works, versus the empirical evidence to suggest that it should. Sorry, just a quick one. Just thinking, what's a DS for non-cycling aficionados?
So a DS is, it stands for Director Sportive. So in English, sports director. So they would be in charge of the sporting side of an athlete and races. So at races, they are in charge of the team. They deal with all of the tactical decisions. They deal with the logistics. They're the guy usually driving the car or in the passenger seat of the race car that's following the race. They'll be on the radio to the riders, communicating tactics, warning them. So they would be, they form a sort of triangle of performance between the coach, athlete, and themselves. So we would do more of the training side and performance aspect, and then we would feed information to the director about how a certain athlete is going, whether they're on good form, whether they need an easy day, and then it's down to the director to put that into place.
Yeah, that's one parallel where cycling is slightly different. I think in a lot of other, particularly like team sports, that DS role would be called a coach mm-hmm. in other sports, who comes up with a tactical game plan and the tactical framework, or, you know, the tactical model for the team. Whereas in cycling, it's the director sportif. So, like you say, it's an interesting parallel. It's just called different things.
Yes, yeah, and the role of a sports scientist and a coach is a pretty new one within World Tour cycling.
Right,
trainers were always there, but they would work with the rider pretty individually. But to have a sports scientist and a coach on the staff of a World Tour cycling team is pretty new. There might have been one or two along the way, but generally it wasn't as common as it is now. Whereas most teams now are going quite data driven, quite sports science led, just because of the insights that a sports scientist and a coach that really can work with the data can provide.
And do many teams have actual dedicated analysts, performance analysts, data scientists, just focusing on the data to support the coaches and DSs?
I would say most. There may be a few teams that don't and rely more on just what a standard coach can deliver. But I think more and more teams are looking towards data as a way of getting an edge on the performance.
So do you have someone doing that for you within Israel Startup?
Yeah, that would be me. So I'm working with a few companies to develop a sort of quite a novel data-driven platform with which the whole team can use, but to different levels. So a sports scientist and coach might really be able to dig into the data on the platform, whereas the management might get a more overview of the whole team, but not necessarily need to dig down into the real nitty gritty numbers. The doctor might get an overview of the medical aspects. So that's a way that you can utilize data, but not have this avalanche of data that is just unusable for the practitioners.
So it comes to quite a good point, I guess, to bring on your what your current role is. So I guess with Israel Startup Nation, there's probably about 30 riders, and are you in charge of all 30 and their training plans, or how does that kind of get split out?
No, we have got a group of coaches. So we've got four performance coaches working for the team, and each having different amounts of riders. So I'm directly coaching four riders. And the reason that it's only four is because I've got a lot of other sort of hats that I wear in terms of job description, in terms of the data analytics, looking after time trial and aerodynamics. You would look after a certain number of athletes, but you would have an overview of all of the athletes. So if you, if you wanted to find out what a specific athlete, you could still look at their data or talk to that athlete's coach specifically.
And what is your, what does your week look like? I'm assuming there's not a typical one, but kind of a general idea of what a week looks like.
There's no typical work week or work day, but to give you a sort of rough overview, usually the morning I would check in with the athletes that I directly coach. Make sure that they're okay. We don't need to adjust anything with training, or if we do put something into place, maybe the weather's turned for the worse and we need to do split session or change the intervals that they're doing. Then once the athletes have gone out the door, usually that's around 10 o'clock European time. Most of the sort of athlete driven communication then goes to the afternoon. So there's a midday portion where I could do more administrative tasks, work on the aerodynamics project, work on the data analytics project. And then once the athletes start coming back in, I'm checking in with them, seeing how their training sessions went, whether we need to adjust anything with future sessions. It could be that I'm on the phone with each of them for anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour and a half. So it really depends on what the day is. So if it's an easy session, you might be 5 minutes and just say, great job, good recovery session there. Or if it was a more intense, long training session, then you might want to talk about that a bit more. Then a lot of the other sports scientists and practitioners are either based in America or down under. So generally the afternoons, evenings are for team meetings. So from about 3 o'clock onwards, I might have, anywhere from one meeting to five or six or seven meetings, all about different things. And then it's putting that into place before I can have supper and head to bed.
So when you're debriefing a training session with the riders after they get back in, are you using data from the ride to drive that conversation, or is that more of a feel sort of conversation?
Both. So right. On their ride, they'll have we use Hammerhead data collection devices. So that's a head unit that will be on the handlebars that will connect to a power meter on the bike's cranks. So you'll be able to see second by second power data. You'll be able to get heart rate data from the athlete, speed, GPS, everything. Once they finish their ride, that will upload directly to an online training platform called Training Peaks, where I can go in, look into the data, check whether they've done the work that I've set, dig into the analysis. And then there's an offline platform called WKO, where you can get even more granular with the data and pick out some insights based on that. And then I'll usually pick up the phone and say, how did the session go? Get more of a subjective feeling from the athlete, because seeing the numbers is one thing, but if you have really great numbers but the athlete felt terrible, then you might not be as happy as if they said, great numbers, great feeling. That would be a good day. The mixture of the two.
That must be a hard balance because, I cycle quite a lot, which is always awkward to say in these meetings when we talk about professional cyclists. And you can go out and you can feel awful, and then halfway through you do an interval or you do a you go for KOM on Strava or whatever, and you feel it comes out really good. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to, I guess it must be hard to walk that line between just saying, well, you need to hit 400 watts, and if you don't hit 400 watts, you're not doing what we're asking, whilst also saying, you know, finding the balance of how they're feeling and what, you know, emotional state they're in.
Yeah, definitely. And there are some athletes that would, you know, if you had that interval at 400 watts and they felt really bad, there are some athletes that would drop it down to 380 or 390 and say, okay, still get the interval done, but at a lower power. And there's some athletes that would just grit their teeth and get through it and suffer like a dog. But generally speaking, you know, most of these athletes, the sort of proprioception and sort of self subjective feelings of their body is incredible. They know the minute they jump on the bike, they'll know what they feel. And they'll be able to look at a training session and say, okay, today I'll be able to get this done even before they've got on the bike. Or say, hang on a minute, no, we're going to need to dial that down today. So a lot can change over a 4, 5, 6 hour training session. You can feel terrible the first hour and then you pick up from the second hour onwards. And for a lot of the more experienced guys, that does actually happen. In an aspect, that's what you're trying to train some guys for, especially the guys who excel in the really long classic races and things like that. And the Grand Tours is, you don't need to have them performing super well in the first hour. Generally, it's the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth plus hour that you really need to make sure that they are performing well at.
I guess it must be hard as well to give them that, that knowledge that they're not going well in the first hour, but that's okay, because they do start going well in hour two onwards, and those kind of like, I guess, emotional cues to just say, look, you're not having a good day for this first hour, but you never have a good day for the first hour, then it will pick up.
Yeah. And a lot of the times that's usually the athlete saying that to you rather than the other way around. They'll say, like, because they'll have been competing, you know, even by the time they get pro, even as a neo pro, they'll have been racing and training for at least probably 5 years. So, and that's continuous. They will have really, really dialed into what they are as a trainer, as an athlete, and how they train and how they feel when they're training. So generally when you have that first, when you sort of approach an athlete as a new coach, you would try to find out all those intricacies. You know, how do you feel on your training rides? Do you have any quirks or, you know, things that I would need to know as a coach? And they might say to you, yeah, usually I leave it 2 hours before I start doing any intervals, because I know that 2 hours in, I just don't feel good. So I start doing my work after that. So it's, you have to really understand each athlete you working with.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge, actually, as a coach working in a pro team versus a national team, where you might work with a rider for 10 years. And so you both know each other inside out. Like you say, how do you try to accelerate that trust between you and the athlete? And how do you approach something if, say they've been doing something for 5, 6, 7 years, and you think, actually, I wish they wouldn't do that, and I've got the data to back up that perhaps this is a better way to do it. How would you then start to try to initiate change in someone who might only be at the team for a couple of years, perhaps?
Yeah, it is a challenge. There's quite short-natured sort of aspect of pro, you know, World Tour cycling versus Olympic National Federation. So working with an athlete, communication is key. So having that immediate first chat and trying to set yourself up as someone who is there for a reason and, you know, has the credentials, has the know-how to be able to support them well. So there is a delicate balance, which if an athlete has something that you kind of think, oh, I really wish they weren't doing this, or there might be a better way of doing this, you've got to weigh up, okay, is changing this and disrupting their own mental preparation and their own sort of cycle of doing things, is that going to outweigh the benefits of the new aspect? So you've kind of got to have a kind of self decision of, okay, am I really going to try and change this, or is there another hill to die on, essentially?
Or do I have to work with almost what I'm given here and make the best of this rather than putting it into, you know, I guess your ideal setup. Mm-hmm. Let's work with what we've got for this period of time. And mm-hmm. I guess you've got to weigh up the, you know, it's almost like a cost benefit analysis of the two approaches, isn't there?
Yes. And but equally said, there are a lot of athletes who are very open to trying new things. You know, I think most athletes realize that they've got to kind of try different things to put a novel stress on their body, to try to break through to another level. So if you come to them and say, okay, we're going to try this session, this is what it's based on, this is what it's doing, this is why we should do it, they will probably 9 times out of 10 say, yeah, let's give it a go. And then, you know, they might send you a message afterwards, say, no, I'm not doing that again, or say, yeah, that was good. Let's incorporate some more of that.
Because in my experience, cyclists are pretty receptive to data and pretty comfortable dealing with it. So I guess, you know, it makes it easier for you in terms of creating an argument to suggest why they should do something. You can actually present data to them. Is that what you found?
Yes. Yeah. Most generally when I've sort of had a chat with each athlete after their training session, they've already done this pretty much the same thing as I've done, but maybe to a lesser level. So they've gone in and checked their own power file. They've looked at their intervals. So because it's something that even as an amateur athlete, you've got access to your heart rate data, you've got access to potentially a power meter, and you can look in. So by the time you become a professional cyclist, you know how to analyze a training session, but getting those physiological insights and having that objective view of performance from a coach, that's where a really interesting discussion can happen. You're not talking them through what they've done in a session. You're sort of trying to make deeper links. And,
yeah, you're the next stage on already.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So one thing that I think separates cycling from a lot of other sports is obviously if we talk about football, you've kind of got the same week in, week out. You've got one game, two games, and then it finishes in May. It starts up again in August, and that's every year it's kind of the same. Mm-hmm. Whereas I guess with cycling, if you've got, you know, say, for example, Chris Froome, I know, is the new addition, alongside you, Caelan, the new addition to the Scarlet Nation. And he has to...
Same salary, I heard.
Yeah, I heard that as well.
Don't talk about that.
You know, with Chris Froome, he has to, assuming that the tour starts in July, as it's scheduled to, he has to be at nearing of his peak form on, you know, July, the whatever it is this year, the 7th or so. That must be incredibly challenging to try and plan 7 months ahead to get someone to their level.
Yes, definitely. I mean, planning the year of a cyclist is, you could do it in December and you've set out their race calendar and you can give it a best guess, but they could get to a race in January and, you know, knock on wood, this doesn't happen, but you could get it to a race in January and they crash or get ill. And that you kind of really need to be adaptive in the programming that you are doing with each athlete. Equally said, they might not crash themselves, but another rider crashes and they get put into a race as a reserve for a race that you were kind of looking at that period and saying, oh, this was a great training block, and now we've got to shove a race in here, and you know, it might not be what you want to do physiologically, but you have to make it work. You've got to be adaptable. So yeah, it is very challenging setting out the year of an athlete, and it's something that if you don't pay attention to, you can get lost in your sort of programming quite quickly.
One thing that I find fascinating is, I think it was Simon Yates was talking about this in the Giro, maybe last year or the year before, where he said that the first week was so easy that he had tapered before it and then hit the first week and then felt like he was basically, you know, 2 week kind of taper to where he was. So I guess, well, two questions. First of all, can you explain what a taper is for those out there? And also, is that a challenging kind of, why is it a problem that the first week is easy? Because I guess most people think, great, first week's easy. That sounds brilliant.
Yeah. So, I mean, a taper would be a managed adjustment of training load and intensity coming into a race. So usually you would reduce the volume, sort of maintain or even increase sometimes the intensity to basically reach optimal performance for a specific point in time. So for this instance, if you taper in the week coming up to a Grand Tour and then the first week of the Grand Tour is very easy. You might have expected to have a little bit more physiological load in that first race week, so that the fatigue builds in a certain way, or it can be quite a shock to the body if you go from a very easy period of riding to suddenly a very hard period of riding. So a lot of athletes the day after a rest day can struggle quite a lot. So that's why on a rest day on a Grand Tour, they'll always go for a short ride, do a few intense kicks and things like that, just to keep their body working. So it's almost as if you would think of it as a big warm-up. So the taper would be your warm-up. And then if you have this really easy first week of a Grand Tour, it's like sitting down on a bench for 20 minutes, you know, in between your warm-up and your event. You don't want that to happen. You want to get performing straight away. So if that first week had been a bit more intense, the management of the training load might have been more optimal there.
Do you have to guess kind of what the first week's going to be like? Because obviously, you know, you can have a flat first week in Normandy, mm-hmm. but the wind blows and it ends up being completely hectic. Or you might have a, like the first week of the tour this year, obviously I don't know exactly what the data says, but it seemed like it was going to be really hard, but actually most of the time it was relatively straightforward. Is that kind of just guesswork?
Yeah, you would look at the geographical regions and look at the likelihood of crosswinds coming up, you know, the parkour style, you know, where the potential crosswinds sections might be, might give you an indication about the likelihood that day is going to be furiously hard. But it is a lot of guesswork saying, okay, because a team on the day could be like, right, let's light this up. Let's do something that no one expects, and then all your plans go out the window. But equally, it can be quite, you know, physiologically easy, but very mentally stressful. So if you think about the first stage of the Tour de France this year with the wet and the crashes, that wasn't necessarily a super hard physiological load, but a lot of riders were struggling the day after just because of the stress with you know, a pretty dangerous parkour in the wet. It was a very unexpectedly hard day for a lot of riders.
Hmm. And how much time, and I know this probably falls a bit more into the DS's role potentially, like you mentioned, you know, a team might light it up and do something completely unexpected. How much, you know, do you put into that sort of race strategy around trying to do something that maybe other teams wouldn't expect, or unsettle them or unsettle certain riders and do something a bit different on certain days?
Oh, well, a lot. We're starting to build our race plans and pre-race plans and tactical planning for most races of the year. So some races have released their parkour, the route that the race will do, others haven't. So there's a bit of guesswork in at the moment. But so you'll come into a race knowing what days you want to really take charge on, or when you might want to have an easy day. But you have to be very adaptive. And for a lot of the big races, they will be probably a member of staff, usually a coach or a what's called a soigneur, a team helper, who will drive ahead of the race on the same route, looking at course conditions, road surface, wind speed. So, your weather app may say one thing, but out on the course, with a wind gauge, you can say, actually, there's a section here of, 15K of crosswind that's not normal to have or not expected to have based on the weather forecast. So then they would feed that back to the race car, and that sort of adaptive planning on the road that happens within the race as well.
So I guess moving on slightly, so you've obviously been in the Sol for, well, not this specific team, but for 3 years. So how has your approach changed to that over time?
I think when I started at Dimension Data, because I was an athlete, I realized that you can come at it from a sports scientist, very fixed mindset. And as an athlete, you'd look at something that you might say and go, well, I don't really want to do that. So to have a foot in the camp of an athlete and have a foot in the camp of a sports scientist and coach, I felt like I had quite a good balance. And it was just refining that balance about how sports science-y I needed to be when I was speaking with the athletes. But definitely over the past 2 and a bit years of working in World Tour Cycling, it's just trying to work out the intricacies and how best to deliver your work and how best to do that. Because it's not all just sitting at home writing training plans. It's being on the road, being adaptive, putting your hand up and saying, yeah, I'll go and do, you know, the course recon for the Tour de France stages, you know, because I'm driving from this race to that race and they're along the way. So yeah, that was an example that I did in 2019. I was going from one race in the Netherlands, and then the next race that I was doing was a week later in, no, it was 4 days later in towards the south of France. So I had a team car. I could have driven all the way along the motorway, but I was like, right, I'm going to take the back roads and drive the route of the tour with a GoPro in the dashboard and record the last 30K, so that even though it was 3 months away, the sports director could look at the course and say, oh, that looks different than the GPS or the Google Maps shows. And when you're talking with your riders, you can say, yeah, that climb was trickier than I thought, or it was steeper in this section, or it's shaded from the sun, from the trees, but, you know, on Google Maps, there's no trees because they're newly planted or something. So yeah, you've got to be quite adaptive, and just learning how to be adaptive would be something that I said that I've learned more how to do over the past 2 years.
I guess there's got to be a huge amount of empathy as well, because obviously if you're telling someone do 10 sets of 500 watts for 5 minutes, then, you know, at some point someone's going to go, look, I can't do this anymore. Or, you know, I guess you've got to have that empathy to kind of not get to that stage, just kind of know exactly the level that is not too much, but also not too little, and try and find that balance.
Yeah. And You can plan by the watt, but a lot of the work that I do when you're looking for that real high end power is done by perception of effort. It's something that I've touched on in my my whole PhD thesis is about it. So definitely allowing the athlete that freedom to adjust the power. So usually what I do is give them a power target, but make it very clear that, okay, on a good day you might be able to do 10 watts higher than this. On a bad day you might need to bring it down by 10. To have that flexibility built into the training prescription is very useful.
Before we go into the final three questions, something I'm always fascinated by is that obviously a lot of people now who cycle, even if not to a high level, have at the minimum heart rate, mm-hmm. Often power, mm-hmm. as well. And that stuff is obviously all out there. And
are you about to ask for a training program here? This is where this feels like this is going.
So I've seen if you've done it, Mike.
I was
just trying to work out whether it was possible for me to. we spoke with Jack Haig about 2 years ago, and I revealed my then FTP to him, which was not very high. So this wasn't an attempt to try and reveal my new FTP, but, you know, it was more asking that, you know, people who, you know, amateurs will put all their stuff on Strava, and you never expect that a professional will, because you feel like that must be proprietary information that they don't want to share. But I know that you're working with Alex Dowsett this year, who was a world hour record holder, and also you worked with Victor Campenaerts for the last 2 years, mm-hmm. who is the world hour record holder. And both of them are incredibly open about what power they're doing and what data they're doing, and I guess what training they're doing. I know there's a video that Victor put on his YouTube where you talk him through basically what I imagine is previously to that completely private data.
Yeah.
So why do you think that riders are more happy to have that information out there than in public?
I think there is certain characters in cycling that do look at their data and say, yeah, you can see it, but at the end of the day, if you want to copy it, you've got to do it, and you've got to have the sort of physiological backing up to be able to get the most out of it. So showing what training you're doing, you know, there are some teams that might look at that and try to break it down, but I think for most athletes, they are getting more open about, okay, it's not, there's no secret sauce. It's just a lot of hard work. And doing sometimes pretty mundane intervals. There's no magic bullet interval that's gonna add 50 watts to your threshold. It's just by chipping away at that, you know, granite block that you want to make into a statue. That's where the differences are made. And that's why, you know, riders like Victor and Alex are pretty open, because they're like, yeah, if you want to do threshold intervals at you know, 450 watts, then go ahead. You know, if you can get your threshold up there, sure. You know, so I don't think it's as you know, cards held close to the chest as it used to be.
Caelan, we always ask 3 questions of every guest that we have. So the idea is that we're looking at the same thing, basically how people use data and analysis, but from a load of different angles. So we've, you know, had players, we've had coaches, we've had data scientists, we've had a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question we ask is, what, if anything, gets you excited about using data and analysis?
I'm a big lover of patterns. So I try to look for patterns and sort of probabilities in data. You know, growing up as a kid, my dad was a mathematician and a physicist. He taught me maths and physics. I'm terrible at the first one, but if it's on Excel, I can do it. So growing up, he, as an exercise just to become computer literate and to start to be interested in these things, he would, you know, get us to catalog the colors of sweets that we would get in a packet to try to work out, okay, what's the probability that the next packet would have 6 yellow sweets or something like that. So even as a very small child, I was sort of using Excel, trying to work out patterns and say, okay, you know, a purple sweet is the most uncommon sweet. What, you know, and then start to think, why might that be? Is it the pigment of the sweet? So that's definitely carried on. I think a lot of sports scientists are, you know, really like number driven, but I use the numbers to look at the patterns. From my side, you can ask me what specific numbers are, and I'll be like, I'm not off the top of my head, I don't know, but I know what that, you know, how that session is in relation to this session, or how the context behind it. And that sort of really links in with just using data to make sort of informed decisions. So that's probably what excites me about data, is the informed decisions aspect of it.
Yeah. And what data do you use most regularly?
Power. You know, that's an easy one. So if I could have 2 answers, it would be power and heart rate. And then, you know, try to get an aspect of the subjective from the athlete. But, you know, power output as a whole, you get second by second data, or even more granular than that sometimes, but it tells you exactly what the external workload on the athlete was that day.
Is it nice that, like you say, one sort of aspect to monitor, like power, can inform you so much about your sport? Or do you find that limiting, because that's usually the threshold or the barrier that people have got to get through to make advances?
No, I think it does tell a lot. But the tricky thing, you know, nowadays is there are so many different power meters around, that, you know, when you say your threshold's 400 watts, usually what I would say is, okay, what power meter are you using? Is it a power meter that notoriously reads high or reads low? So the competition is an aspect, you know, race results and performance on a day is something that you look at with context, of the power file, that is. So you could do your best power numbers and come last in the race. So some people might say, okay, that was a failure, because you didn't perform well in the race. And then other people might look at it and say, yeah, but in any other tactical, you know, circumstance, you might have won that race. So you kind of have to look through the data and the power data with context as well.
And last of all, I guess, leading on from Mike's question is, what does data level analysis not currently do that you want it to do?
Oh, that's a magic question. Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure. The power of cycling is that there are so many data points that you can gather with real-time power data, real-time heart rate, GPS, climbing, and then the subjective data.
What about opposition data?
One of the things that we were looking at doing is sort of positioning within races. So trying to track where riders are within the peloton relative to the other riders. So to see where our team was clustered, and to actually put that into data so that it's not just subjective. Okay, they're at the back. It's like, are they in the rear 70%? Are they in the rear 30%? But that sort of data collection is a bit limited by the governing body of cycling because it's technically classed as communication with the rider. So anything that you sort of communicate with the rider is only allowed over the radio or vocally. So all of the data that they gather is stored to their head unit, which can't be transmitted sort of back to a centralized location. So similar to like a Formula One might have, you know, a base in the UK, even though they're racing in Australia. That would probably be something that I would really like to have. So access to the rider's data in real time, but at a remote location.
Why do they not allow that? Or is that a silly question?
Oh, it's just a bit of antiquity, you know, it's the antiquity of cycling. I don't want to badmouth the UCI, but sometimes it's a bit closed-minded in terms of the use of data and how to control that. And there's probably also a commercial aspect because some races are partnered with an organization called Velon, which does deliver access to limited amounts of data with that a rider produces in real time. But it's, you know, I would really want that to be within the team and how we can use it sort of individually and harness that data. But just seeing the rider's power in real time is great. You can get some insights in that, but it's really, if you are having that data stream coming in, you could and sort of monitor it over time, you could calculate how many kilojoules have expended over the past 2 hours and how many matches they've spent, and you could then deliver that information to the director remotely and say, okay, you know, this guy's been riding on the front now for 2 hours, he's cooked, don't use him anymore, get someone else to take that job.
Could you change your feeding strategy in the race based on that?
Yes, yeah, definitely. You could tell a rider that they might need to intake more carbohydrates or hydrate more or anything like that. But usually they have a very good finger on that already. So they'll know when they need to push in, and it's something that our sports nutritionists would work with them, developing individual race strategies with each rider.
Do you think we're closer to that than we were before? I know that there's obviously a big push against power meters, which seems to slightly misunderstand that it's not the power meter that's causing racing to be like that. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of an obvious scapegoat, really. But do you think we're closer to having more data in cycling, or do you think we're closer to having less data in cycling?
I think we're closer to having more data in cycling because when you're racing, there's very few riders that are looking down at their power meter and saying, okay, I've got to ride this number. And when you do see teams controlling races riding on the front, they may glance at their power meter, but a lot of the time they might have to go above what's sustainable to chase down an attack. But they know the feeling of it. They'll be able to say, okay, I can manage this for 5 minutes. But take away the power meter, they'll probably do still a very good job of doing that just subjectively, because it's something that they go through day by day. So when I see, okay, let's take away power meters, there's just a big loss of data there that not only are you used within the race, but after the race to develop, okay, what does it take to win this race? It would be kind of like asking a 100-meter sprinter to sprint without a time, a stopwatch.